So the big take-home point is you could extend that to a number of different input, arbitrary input models, and this is all performed in the visibility plane.
Hello, everybody. My name is Ciriaco Good, and I've just started as a Black Hole Camp project scientist literally 1 week ago, working along with Aino, Remo, and the rest of the Nijmegen group. As most of you might know, there is strong tradition of VLBI in Europe, as testified by the long-running European VLBI network operated by Jive, but also at the centimeter wavelengths, but also the GMVA operating at 3 millimeter and coordinated by the Max Planck in Bonn. But there have been interesting recent developments, and I report three boxes here in particular. And, in June 2012, we had ISO host a workshop on millimeter VLBI with ALMA and radio telescopes around the world. It was attended by 61 scientists from EU and five from outside. And this was followed by a white paper that appeared on the archive in June this year, summarizing the science interest of the European users. We got 50 projects from 160 scientists affiliated with 70 different observatories. In the meantime, the European Research Council awarded a synergy grant to Black Hole Camp project involving Radboud University, the Max Planck in Bonn, and the University of Frankfurt, with partners Jive and Max Planck in Garching and ISO to support global millimeter VLBI and pulsars observations. I would like to conclude making a statement that in Europe there is strong interest and support for a global millimeter VLBI facility as an open user facility. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Alejandro Cárdenas, and I'm a master's student at National University of Colombia. So since test the curved nature of black holes is really difficult, here we propose to study another metric, which comes from an inspired non-commutative matter source. So here we just calculate the shadow of the black hole to see if we can just try to measure quantities and defer one curve solution for a non-commutative space. So it is important to analyze the horizons which come in these non-commutative geometries or spirate in non-commutative, and it's really difficult to measure and differ and differentiate one from other with now and future facilities. The only possibility could be if we find a black hole which is really spinning really fast, and even if we can measure it. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Freek Roelofs. I'm a master's student at Radboud University in Nijmegen. And I spent this summer at Haystack Observatory working on imaging ZJ star through time variability. We all know that ZJ star is variable on timescales much shorter than the VLBI observation timescale, as has been mentioned already several times today. And that's why in this project we simulated EHD observations of a GRMHD movie, of which you see a time average image here on the left. And we observed that movie for 8 days, and then we averaged all visibilities with equal UV coordinates. We normalized them and applied a smoothing algorithm. And then what we got is the image here on the right. And as you can see, despite all the variability that is going on, we are still able to reconstruct the characteristic black hole shadow and the emission ring with the EHD. And if you want to know more details about this, please come visit my poster. Thanks.
Hello, my name is Gisela. As you might know, over the past years, people from the EHD project, UMass, INAOE, and UNAM joint efforts to bring online the Large Millimeter Telescope. So on May of 3 years, we observed three millimeters with the LMT and the VLBI. And in my contribution, I would like to discuss with you some results so far. And these results are related to the derivation of some geometric and instrumental corrections that were induced by an antenna error position and by a clock drift. And also, I would like to discuss with you results regarding the phase referencing prospects and imaging. And basically, we have found that baselines longer than the central region of the array result out the emission of Psi star. And also, we have derived a size that is consistent with previous observations and with the predictions of the scattering law. So I will be happy if you go to visit my poster. Thank you.
Hi. We brought a poster here, and on behalf of the Polarization Key Science Program from RadioAstron. As you may be aware, RadioAstron is the new space VLBI project funded by the Russian Academy of Science. With RadioAstron, we have a very elliptical orbit with a very large apogee. And we can get, in principle, theoretical angular resolutions up to about 10 microseconds when observing at the short wavelength, which is 1.3 centimeter. As I said before, we have this polarization key science program, and this is aimed to probe the magnetic field and the innermost region of some of the most brightest BLX and quasars, and so far for the first year of operation, we have been observing BLX 3C273, 3C279, and OJ27. What we have brought here in the poster is mainly the results corresponding to the most interesting results we have got so far, which are BLX observations at 1.3 centimeter. In these observations, we got ground space baseline detections up to about 5 Earth diameters. With this, and pushing a little bit the weighting of the visibilities when doing the imaging, we were able to obtain an image with an angular resolution of 33 microseconds, which is the one shown there, and I believe, in fact, it's the highest angular angular resolution image we obtained so far. So just to summarize, with RadioAstron, we can actually do polarization and to probe the AGNs with this 33 microsecond resolution.
Hi. So I'm Pierre Christian. This is a work I'm doing with Dimitrios Saltis and also Avi Loeb in Harvard CFA. So the point of this poster is essentially that the pulsar time delay is useful and you can use it to measure a lot of different stuff. And the thing is, like, the stuff that you measure actually depends on the location of the pulsar with respect to the black hole. So for example, if you have a pulsar that's close to the black hole, then the pulsar's time delay depends on the metric of the black hole. So for example, that image there in the lower left, that's the spin correction to the Shapiro time delay up to order g. So you can expand the metric, the axisymmetric metric, to orders of g, and that's just g to the one correction. And further away from the black hole, the time delay of the pulsar is affected mostly by acceleration of pulsar, and we can also use that to probe various other things in the galactic center. For example, you can probe the cumulative stellar mass. So in that, in the top right there, it's the cumulative stellar mass is determined by the intersection of those two lines, and you can also determine the characteristic stellar mass, because the characteristic stellar mass in the galactic center changes the acceleration to the pulsar, which in fact changes the time delay of the pulsar. Thank you.
Hi. Here I want to present a poster showing 3 millimeter observations of the nearby object NGC 1052. This source is well known for having a gap in the mission and showing two jets because it is in the plan in the sky at centimeter wavelengths. But if you go to millimeter wavelengths, this frequency absorption disappears, and what you see is really a central object and the two jets going in both directions. And the good thing of this guy is that, look, it is only at 20 megaparsecs. This is more or less the distance of M87. And it has two jets. And then we can pinpoint what is going on really at the region of the black hole. And we believe also to be able to resolve the structure in the north-south direction, in the most compact component. Then we arrive to see at the resolution a region of around 25 Schwarzschild radii. This source had has had in the last times between 300 millijansky and 1 jansky, and given the enhanced sensitivity of the EHT, that will be a great target as well, not only because if it is close, because if it has two jets, and had also a very nice declination at 8 degrees to the south, to be able to be seen by the antennas in the south and in the northern hemisphere. Then keep this source in mind, because it is a good target also for the EHT, and probably we can answer to some of the questions having the two jets and all this central region there. Okay? Thank you.
Hello, my name is Fumie Tazaki. I'm a postdoc in NEOJ, and I've got a PhD in the last March in Kyoto University by studying radio galaxies with X-ray observation, but I've changed my topic, and I'm now studying about radio interferometry imaging with super resolution. The middle blue image is my main result. This is a super resolved image with sparse modeling. The left one is a clean image, so you can see that the limb structure and counter-jet-like structure. Please come to my poster and discuss these results. Thank you.
That's now work. Yep. Okay. Yeah. My name is Riley. So I'm a PhD student at the University of Amsterdam. Sharon Markov is my supervisor. So one thing we've already heard about today is that we have plenty of multi-wavelength data for Sagittarius Star. Some of it simultaneous, but it still turns out that you have a lot of degeneracy in spectral fitting, particularly in the X-ray, where it's uncertain as to whether the spectrum is dominated by some kind of relatively inefficient accretion flow, or whether it's a jet component. And also, we had the questions raised earlier as to whether there is certainly a jet in Sagittarius Star. But you have this relation for other kinds of black holes called the fundamental plane of black hole accretion, which started off as a relation between the radio and X-ray luminosity of black hole binaries in the hard state, and it can be extended to AGN, so black holes of much higher mass, particularly low luminosity AGN, which Sagittarius Star fits into that category. And it turns out that Sagittarius Star fits on the plane when it flares in the X-ray and in the infrared. So the question is, can we try and break some of the spectral fitting degeneracy by using a jet model and fitting it to two sources that fit on the plane at the same time? So that's what I've been doing, is to fit Sagittarius Star and a black hole binary called AO620, which fits on the low luminosity end of the plane, at the same time. And that's, obviously, don't try and read it, but that's my poster, it's what it looks like. Come by and talk to me about it. Thanks.
Hi there. My name is Mike Landry, and I'm a scientist at LIGO Hanford Observatory. And my poster is about a search for gravitational waves, audio band gravitational waves, using the other type of interferometers, Michelson laser interferometers. And LIGO comprises two detectors at two different sites. The top left is our observatory in Hanford, and the top right is in Louisiana. We have a third detector, which is intended for India. So we expect to have a third site later in the project in India, where the third detector components will be. We've just emerged from a four-year upgrade process in which we stripped out the initial LIGO components out of the vacuum envelope and installed new advanced LIGO detectors. And the process after the installation is to commission the detectors and achieve first lock, where you control the interferometer on its resonant state. And the bottom left figure is showing a recent noise curve from the Livingston interferometer, which is locked and running, and we're working on the noise. There at Hanford, we're moving towards first lock. We're staged a little later than them. We expect to be running next year in our first observation run of the advanced LIGO detector. So come on by and I'll tell you about it. Thanks.
Hello, my name is Salome Dibi. I did my PhD at the University of Amsterdam, and I'm now a postdoc at Radboud University of Nijmegen. In my poster, I present some modeling of the emission coming from very close to the central black hole, which is, as you know, the submillimeter peak, but also the infrared and X-ray flare emission. So I propose a new model where I calculate self-consistently the particle distribution. And on the left side is an example of a result of the multi-wavelength spectrum, which is showing synchrotron emission for the reproduction of the data. So now, from this model, I generate some distribution of fluxes in the infrared and X-ray to overcome the limitation of the lack of simultaneous data, and also to generalize the result. So what you can see on your right is an example of the X-ray cumulative flux distribution, which is basically showing the occurrence of fluxes as a function of flux. And this can not only tell us about the emission mechanism at work, but also to describe the behavior of the key parameter in the plasma, such as the non-thermal component of the particles. Thank you. If you can come see the poster.
Hello everybody, I'm Thomas Bronswaar. I just started my PhD under Heino Falke, and my poster entails an overview of the image pipeline that takes us from ray-traced images of GRMHD simulations, which we've seen a bunch of today, you see the swirling gas, and we go all the way to predicted VLBI observables. Now there's two steps to this. First, we model the scattering of the light as it reaches us by convolving the image with a parameterized Gaussian. Then we do a Fourier transform on the resulting image, and we arrive at the visibility phase and the visibility amplitude, which are the predicted VLBI observables in the UV plane. Now my poster is right out here. It's the one with the black and orange color scheme. So if you'd like to see the visual aids to this brief talk, then please join me outside. Thank you.
My name is Christian Brinkerink. I'm a PhD student at Radboud University Nijmegen as well, in Heino's group. There was a minor mishap uploading my slide, but I hope to make it clear enough to you just using a little story. As you all probably know, there are quite a few emission models for Sagittarius star flying around, each trying to predict what we will eventually see with the Event Horizon Telescope setup. And as you heard from Vincent Fish already, closure phases are a useful tool to robustly analyze observables that pertain to these models. We ran a couple of different models through a pipeline that we set up in order to predict what kind of closure phase evolutions we would see. And these models were generated by Monica, and these models basically differ in the sense that they have different electron temperature prescriptions for the disk and for the jet, right? So these are basically the two big contenders in our case. And you can see that they result in wildly different closure phase evolutions over time. We get striking differences, and good closure phase measurements allow us to already eliminate quite a few of these alternative models. We have a nice pipeline set up, so should you have model images of yourself generated by you for which you would like to see what kind of closure phase predictions that they would generate, we might be able to help you. So please come talk to me if you're interested in that. Thank you.
So thank you. Thank you, poster participants. Thank you for coming and listening. Christian, mea culpa, very sorry. And then with that, I think we're going to move on. You guys are welcome to sit down. Move on to the afternoon discussion. Yep, last. Before we start the discussion, let me thank two very important people who've been running up and down with microphones all day. So Mohammed Chalabi and Britt Jeter, who've kindly been bringing microphones to us as we ask questions. I'd like to acknowledge their contribution, and we'll have other people doing it tomorrow as well and acknowledge them as well. Okay, so if I could get the speakers from this afternoon to come and have a seat up here so we can talk to them for a little bit. I think we've scheduled nearly an hour and a half for the afternoon discussion. There's no guarantee that it needs to extend that long, but we've heard a lot, some exciting results this afternoon. We all, I hope, have some questions about them.